A little more about themselves than I'm going to say, although I know everybody and have been working together with people on this issue for a little while here. So this is Jeffrey Strahl, who's an engineer, among other things, a researcher and very independent thinker. This is Joseph Wanzala, who's on the local advisory board of KPFA. That's not the only thing he does, but he can tell. What?
Doesn't know if that's a compliment.
I don't know either. I'm sure you do lots of hard work, Joe, I know that. And lots of hard work on this issue also. And this is Don Paul, who you already just met. And this is Reva Entine, who's the program director of the National Lawyers Guild in San Francisco. And she's going to particularly talk about war on dissent. Don Paul's going to talk about Nazis in the government. Joe's going to talk about Africa and the New World Order. I guess you're going to narrow that. And Jeffrey's going to talk about the buildings falling, the World Trade Center and the other buildings. So say a little bit more about yourselves as you speak so we can put you in context. And it's 8:35. You've got 10 minutes. Okay.
All right. Well, I have a degree in mechanical engineering, and I've been spending the last 3 decades teaching math and statistics at the University of California, specifically the calculus that's used in engineering. And I want to raise questions going further than the video that you saw from Barry Zwicker. He addressed a lot of very important things. There are some things that he didn't address. For example, with the World Trade Center, you had the amazing thing at the World Trade Center of 3 major high-rises that fell due supposedly to fires. Never, ever have high-rises fallen because of fires. September 11th was the only time that that happened. Some other amazing things that I think questions should be raised about. The top of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center are 1,300 feet above the ground. There is a physics equation that you can use, 1/2 gt squared, g being acceleration constant due to gravity, which tells you how far a falling object would get at a time t if it was freely falling through air without encountering any air resistance. 1,300 feet above sea level, such an object would take about 9 seconds to fall down to the ground if it was falling through air. This is how long it took pretty much the top of the World Trade Center to fall down, except that they're not falling through air, they're falling through steel and concrete, supposedly encountering resistance along the way. One would ask why it would only take 9 seconds in that case. Another aspect, supposedly the official story is that the fires created by the collision of the planes with the towers caused the steel to melt, which eventually started the tops falling down on floors, which then each floor fell, causing the next floor to fall, and so on. It was kind of a cascading effect. Well, to begin with, the hottest jet fuel has ever been shown to burn at is 800 degrees centigrade. Structural steel does not even begin to warp until 1,100 degrees centigrade. So as per an article that was posted on the web says, maybe the Muslims have changed the laws of physics, well, at least on one day. And it amazingly burned hot enough to melt steel, and yet just recently there was a report that the DNA of 2 hijackers was identified, even though DNA completely gets destroyed at 150 degrees centigrade. Well, people can believe anything sometimes if they hear it on CNN, I suppose. Then another thing, if a building is hit, the building would tend to fall toward in the direction in which, in the corner in which it was hit. This would be particularly true with the South Tower, which was hit only on one corner. Yet the buildings fell straight down. The story is that the buildings did not have cross beams, only outer beams and a core, and they were connected by trusses, even though photos posted on the web at Indy Media clearly show that the trusses are actually beams. This is if you go to indymedia.org article 228615, you'll see photos like that. I would also suggest that you go to article 203765 for details on much of the physics. The South Tower was hit later than the North Tower, and yet it collapsed half hour before. Why did that happen? What was the mechanism there? And an interesting detail that 2 days after the World Center collapsed, a man by the name of Van Romero from the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, who is a world-renowned expert on structures, on sabotage, and particularly on terrorist attacks, remarked that it looked to him like the airplanes were basically a ruse, that the buildings were actually demolished by explosives. He had no idea what he was talking about, you know, what the implications of what he said were, because the next day, the paper, the Albuquerque paper, which printed this article, printed a retraction, which precedes the article now, if you go to the website. And in the retraction, he says, oh, I didn't mean to say anything. I didn't mean to say something happened or something didn't happen. Sounds to me like in the lingo of New York City, like maybe he had maybe he fell down the stairs. Interestingly enough, when the whole thing happened, as the collapse started, seismographs belonging to the Columbia University actually showed a spike that happened before any debris hit the ground. One would wonder why, you know, once again, what was producing such a spike. There are many questions that I'm not even raising about the World Trade Center. I'm suggesting that people go to these websites and read about them. Well, one more thing I wanted to mention. The buildings were designed for a collision with a plane. People say they were designed for a collision with a 707 and not a heavier 767. In truth, if you go to the Boeing Corporation's own website, the 707 weighs less, it travels at a faster speed. The kinetic energy that a 707 packs is more than that of a 767. Calculations are actually done. And I'd be happy to share the websites on it. When it comes to the Pentagon, other questions get raised, for example, by somebody named, for somebody at Alberta Indy Media, article 4578. Gerard Holmgren, whose article also at Maritimes Indy Media would be very worthwhile pursuing. This is article with Maritimes Indy Media 4086. For example, the person who flew the airplane, Flight 77, which supposedly hit the Pentagon, his name was Hani Anjur. He was judged to be incompetent to fly even a small plane. Yet when he piloted this Flight 77, he was able to make a 270-degree turn going down 7,000 feet in a matter of 2 minutes, a maneuver which would be difficult to conduct with a fighter plane, let alone a jetliner. Yet somehow this guy who couldn't fly a small plane was able to do it. And you know what the amazing thing is? The whole point of this maneuver was to hit the least important part of the Pentagon, the part that was just recently renovated and had very little in it. I mean, why would somebody do such a weird maneuver in order to hit the least important target instead of flying through the top? There were many stories about the Pentagon not even being hit by a plane. So the Pentagon issued some photos to try to refute it. One photo shows a vapor trail and supposedly the plane hidden behind the post. The post is not big enough to hide a plane, and jets do not emit vapor trails, especially not flying at ground levels, especially not in warm weather. The only things that emit vapor trails at such low altitudes are missiles, such as, for example, a cruise missile. Also, a passenger jet has a soft nose where the instruments are. It's designed to shatter upon impact, so as to ensure that all the instruments remain in one limited area. Whatever hit the Pentagon went through three rings, which is a total of 6 containment walls. Certainly not something that a soft-nosed airliner would be able to do. And it amazingly did not burn any of the grass that was outside. The halls that are in the Pentagon are so way too small for any jetliner to go through. And the jetliner, the wings, suddenly, nothing is left of the jetliner. The wings supposedly collapsed, but no pieces are left. What happened to those planes? And what exactly happened at the World Trade Center? Well, unfortunately, we'll never find out about the Trade Center. You know what happened to all the structural steel that remained behind? It was quickly collected and shipped off to China. Now, no investigations are possible. Fire Engineering magazine had an editorial in January 2002 condemning this complete elimination of evidence as being totally contrary to any investigation that has ever been done about any crane collapse. Something is drastically wrong here, folks. And I'm very upset that not only the media, but even the so-called left media, the alternative media, continues to accept the official story of what happened at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon without even asking a single question.
Hi.
Does it seem too loud?
Is it working? Let's use this one instead. Hi, my name is Joe Gonzalez. And I've been, occupying the margins, the underground of research. What to me used to be just, mainstream, quote unquote, mainstream research, the way things work, until I came across the Atlantic to the United States 15 years ago and discovered that a lot of what I just took as normal political phenomena is regarded here as conspiracy theory. What I'm going to try to do this evening is draw some linkages between political events on the African continent, the events of 9/11, and the impending war in Iraq. I'm basically going to read and ad lib a little bit on a prepared statement I put together, mainly to ensure that I remain within Susan's strict time constraints. The major folly of the current anti-war or peace movement, I think, is one of consciousness. And I think that if there's no major transformation in that consciousness, all opposition to Bush's agenda really is futile. I say this because, ultimately, the anti-war movement, even as it opposes the specific agenda of the plan to attack and colonize Iraq, still not only fails to question, but buys into the fundamental mythology of 9/11. This mythology is the legitimizing force driving the engine of Imperial America's entire agenda. This proposed war on Iraq is really not about Bush. It is about the inexorable logic of mammon, of empire. Colonization and control of the world's resources is an imperative of empire. If Bush was not in office, Clinton or Gore, or whichever other Republican in office, would be doing the same thing. The bombing of Yugoslavia was an imperial war of colonization as much as this war on Iraq has been for the last 12 years and will be. Furthermore, this war will be an extension of the ruthless quest to control the world's increasingly scarce strategic resources, as Barry Zwicker was discussing in the video we saw earlier. It is a process that we in Africa have experienced and continue to experience in all its ugliness to this day and beyond. Needless to say, African countries reflexively oppose the war in Iraq, as we clearly recognize this as part of a colonizing mission. This past February 24th, at the opening of the 13th Summit Conference of the Non-Aligned Movement in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, the President of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, speaking against the impending attack on Iraq, quoted from William Butler Yeats' poem, The Second Coming, written in 1919 amid the wreckage of World War I. This poem was the Irishman's prescient vision of the worst that was yet to come. And I'll quote a few lines from it. Turning and turning the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. After a few more lines, the poem concludes, "The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born." Yeats's frame of reference was European civilization seeming to fall apart at the dawn of the 20th century. Yeats's dread image of a rough beast slouching towards Bethlehem is certainly a powerful metaphor for the US Army's deployment to the Middle East as we speak. The horrors of the next decade since Yeats wrote this poem have been, and continue to be, by any measure, the bloodiest, most destructive, and most shameful in human history. The phrase, "things fall apart," from Yeats's poem, was adopted by Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe as the title of his novel, which was an allegory for the contradictions and paradoxes of post-colonial Africa, and is certainly one of the most important novels in African literature, certainly a signal one at the beginning of the so-called post-colonial era. Africa is still falling apart, and liberal intellectuals in the West are unabashedly advocating the recolonization of the continent. One particular dismal instance of this was Paul Johnson's article entitled, this is in the New York Times magazine, the article was entitled, "Colonialism is Back, and Not a Moment Too Soon. Some countries are just not fit to govern themselves." This is the New York Times in April 18, 1993. Johnson's exhortation to the West to recolonize the Third World was evidently heard very clearly in the West, specifically the United States, which was at that time invading Somalia, as you might remember, and laying out plans to brutally colonize through a proxy war the Great Lakes region of Africa, where Uganda, Rwanda, and the Congo lie. I'll talk over the next 5 minutes about the war in the Congo. But the signal event, some of you may remember in 1994, the genocide that took place there. Many of you may not remember the event that precipitated that genocide. The event itself was much discussed, but I think very little understood. The link I see to 9/11, as we're discussing, is that the whole thing was essentially, it was what some researchers call a false flag operation. That is, an event coordinated, a covert military event is coordinated and used to justify subsequent government operations. And I think almost every major conflagration in world history has been preceded by a false flag operation. That is a sort of diversionary event coordinated by the aggressor state designed to manipulate public opinion. As I mentioned earlier, the anti-war movement has generally accepted the legitimizing myth of the post 9/11 New World Order. The anti-globalization movement, in turn, has generally accepted one of the most unkind lies about Africa, that Africans, for no apparent reason, set about murdering one another in a genocidal orgy that left nearly 1 million dead. Many people in the West know about the genocide in Rwanda, but have no understanding of the wider geopolitical significance of the event. It is understood mainly as a sort of spontaneous combustion of African barbarism, especially as it took place in the region of Africa that inspired Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. During the early 1990s, I'm going to talk about some political entities and personalities. Please bear with me if the names are unfamiliar, but I'll try to put them in context during the question and answer period. During the 1990s, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, composed of Rwandan Tutsis and led by Paul Kagame, who was trained at the U.S. Army Officers College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and recently spoke in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club, has been making incursions into Rwanda from Uganda, with the assistance of U.S. Special Forces troops and the Defense Intelligence Agency. The objective was to invade Rwanda and from there launch an invasion into the neighboring Congo, overthrow the outmoded Mobutu Sese Seko, and install another new and improved puppet dictator, in this case, Laurent Kabila. Things didn't turn out the way they planned, since Laurent Kabila decided to have a mind of his own, but that's a story that I can't go into here due to the time constraints we have. The fact that Rwandan Tutsis had been threatening to invade Hutu-controlled Rwanda for some time, as well as the strict World Bank and IMF economic regime imposed on Rwanda, had created an extremely tense political condition in that country. Tinderbox conditions, really. In the spring of 1994, when the presidents of Rwanda and neighboring Burundi were returning from peace talks in Arusha, Tanzania, their plane was shot down. This event sparked off the mass killings in Rwanda. The Clinton administration refused to allow the United Nations to intervene, even though they had clear intelligence information about exactly what was going to happen. The order to shoot down the plane was given by Paul Kagame. And by the way, a French court recently dismissed a defamation lawsuit filed by Kagame against a Paris-based journalist called Charles Onana, whose book, The Secrets of the Rwandan Genocide, Investigation of the Mysteries of a President, charges that Kagame was responsible for shooting down the plane. Although the pretext for the invasion of Rwanda from Uganda was to stop the genocide, Kagame never stopped the genocide in Rwanda. In collaboration with his allies in the then Clinton administration, Kagame prevented any international intervention in order to avoid interference in the grand plan of the Americans and other allies in the region, Uganda principally, to launch an attack into the Congo. What has happened in the Congo since that time and why it has happened is a major untold story that even the progressive media in the United States has utterly failed to report in any meaningful way. The war in the Congo has claimed over 3 million lives since 1998 alone. Innocent civilians have been brutalized, massacred, raped, and tortured by all parties in the conflict. It began with a U.S. sponsored invasion of Rwanda in 1994 and followed with two subsequent U.S. sponsored invasions of Congo, principally through their proxy army, Uganda, in 1996 and 1998. I'm Ugandan, by the way, so this is not some kind of bias against Ugandans. These are not the simple civil wars declared by the Western press. Even the Rwandan genocide has, to some extent, been manufactured in the American mind to serve the mythology of tribalism. Meanwhile, American Green Berets and military advisors and Pentagon officials have participated in those wars from the blackboard to the battlefield. Sierra Leone, Angola, Sudan, and the Congo Zaire region are wars where factions are armed with U.S.-made weapons, M16s, and so on, where U.S. covert forces undertake brutal secret missions and psychological operations, accountable to no one, behind the headlines. They are wars where the Central Intelligence Agency is deeply and maliciously entrenched in subverting democracy and orchestrating chaos that is expediently advertised as such by a dubious media. At the roots, however, these are wars like any other war. Essential to the super alloys and weaponry of the global economy of war are Congo's cobalt, uranium, and columbium tantalite, otherwise known as coltan. Cobalt is elemental to nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons, tank armor, industrial furnaces, and aerospace. And for 50 years, the CIA has ensured the free flow of cobalt out of the Congo. The human devastation in poverty, disease, torture, and massacres is uncountable. Adjectives do not describe the suffering. Similarly, coltan is essential for cell phones and children's PlayStations, and companies like Sony and Nokia have been cashing in on this windfall, paid in human blood. This greater involvement of the powerful American and European interests in the Congo's resource war remains completely obscured. It is continually cast as just African chaos. For example, Royal Dutch Shell has allied with the aforementioned Rwandan Patriotic Front, the post-1994 victors, both overtly and covertly supported by U.S. military operations and equipment. According to investigative journalist Wayne Madsen, who wrote a book called Genocide and Covert Operations in Africa, a copy of which I have here, since 1994, the Rwandan Patriotic Front government, headed by Paul Kagame, has systematically eliminated upwards of 600 people. These, in addition to the International Rescue Committee's count of 3 million dead since 1998, the RPF forces and the Congolese allies have reportedly conscripted prisoners of war for slave labor in mining camps in Zaire, now called the Congo. When Bill Clinton stated that the U.S. took no action on Rwanda in 1994 because we did not know what was going on at the time, he could not have told a beer lie. Indeed, the nasty executive underhandedness of Bush and Clinton interests in Africa are meticulously documented in Wayne Madsen's book. North America and European multinational corporations are pulling the strings to ensure their cheap and unfettered access to oil, natural gas, gold, diamonds, rubber, and timber. In Lake Albert, in the area of Congo's forests, multinationals are sinking wells for petroleum and natural gas. Shell, Exxon, Chevron, Mobil, Egypt, and Totalfina are few of the petroleum giants controlling the oil fields off the Atlantic. Another aspect of the story in the Congo, which foreshadows the current diplomatic standoff in Iraq, was that a lot of what's happening in the Congo at another level was a rivalry between the French and the Americans for control of the Congo's resources, as we're seeing again in Iraq. A lot of what is behind the French opposition to U.S. invasion of Iraq is imperial rivalry. So as the Congo, Colombia, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and other points of imperialist resources extraction go, so goes Iraq. In closing here, I'll offer another interpretation of Yeats's phrase, the center cannot hold. The resource wars that we are seeing are a function of the unquenchable need of Western capitalist societies for resources in the third world. While on the one hand, the breadth and depth of the anti-war movement is heartening, it is also to a certain extent contradictory, because ultimately, the moves by Bush to gain gain control of oil are consistent with the interests of American corporations. And American corporations are the backbone of America's political center, whose opposition to Bush has more to do with small-c political rivalry than anything else. After all, Clinton did in Yugoslavia exactly what Bush is proposing to do in Iraq. George Bush is in a way a manifestation of the fact that the American way of life, the center, may indeed fall apart without control of the world's most important resource, oil.
It's this probably. I'll just do this. I was writing a column for the San Francisco Bayview in 2001 when the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon occurred. And I wrote a series of six columns in the 3 months thereafter. And some people asked that they be compiled, so I began to write an introduction for them last spring. And it stretched to 6 months of work and became over 100 pages. And consequently, it's a book called 9/11, Facing a Fascist State. And what I learned over a year of research and writing includes a lot of the facts that Jeff cited, the gaping holes in the official story around the buildings in particular. And more evidence just continues to come in that points to the physical impossibilities, not just the implausibilities that Barry mentioned, but the impossibilities of it happening as U.S. government officials and corporate media and left establishment media depict it. For one thing, cell phones don't work above 8,000 feet. A very good researcher and person, I think. A.K. Dewdney, a professor in Western Ontario, has kind of impeccable credentials. He wrote a column for Scientific American for 8 years. Anyway, he went to the length of renting a light plane and flying it up and trying 4 different models of cell phone, and none of them were operable above 8,000 feet. And I think we all remember the exchanges between passengers and their loved ones that supposedly took place through cell phone communication. So another big hole. Another quite large hole is that 5 hijackers remain alive. 5 of the hijackers indicted by the FBI in December of 2001 are still alive. Another quite large hole is WT-7, also falling straight down, wasn't hit by a plane, only had 2 visible fires immediately before its collapse. The other really big hole that you can kind of investigate endlessly is why the jets didn't intercept, and I think Barry's video got into that enough for anybody to draw their conclusions. But what I really learned, and it was kind of heavy work because the more I dug into it, was how large a web and how vicious a web it is that oppresses us. And it led me back into the Bush family history, which is the history of collaboration with fascism that goes back at least till Prescott in the 1920s and 1930s. As you know, Prescott is the grandfather of George W. Bush. He was partner with W.A. Averill Harriman in the Union Banking Corporation, which owned the Silesian American Mining Corporation, which used slave labor at Auschwitz up until 1942, for one instance of complete Nazi-dom. And I think we're probably all familiar with the leading families of the United States being collaborators with Nazi Germany. The Rockefellers, the Hearsts, and so forth. But what is interesting to me as I followed that was learning that many of the key Nazi intelligence and scientific community were taken out of the United States, or out of Europe, put into the United States. Yeah, would they were taken out of the United States. Yeah, but anyway, they came with the aid of Alan Dulles and Henry Kissinger and other gophers for the Rockefellers shortly after World War II and occupied some of the key positions in our aeronautic and defense industries, as well as being big intelligence helpers. But even more interesting than that to me is how they have become dominant in the pharmaceutical corporations. And that kind of leads to, if I may jump, to our very present and the Nazis as our government and our government as a corporate state that has nothing to do with representative democracy, and why that is so both fearful and galvanizing for us, I think. IG Farben was a major corporation of Nazi Germany. It was broken up into this and that after World War II. Among the entities it was broken up into was 3 large pharmaceutical companies, Bayer, Hoechst, and can you remember the other one? There you go. Anyway, 2 of these pharmaceutical corporations have the licenses for some of the vaccines against anthrax or smallpox. And I find that very perilous because I think for the reasons that Jeff and Joe both enumerated right now, we've got an administration that's really a gang, and I wish I could get into all the things, like Frank Carlucci being in the Congo in 1961 as an agent for the CIA at the time that Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, being deported from another African nation 4 years later after another assassination, and he's now, after being Secretary of Defense under Reagan and this and that under Carter and so on and so forth, the head of the Carlyle Group, which employs James Baker and John Major and George H.W. Bush, which in sum, to me, points out to being the corporate state is really just a criminal syndicate bent on taking as much as it can from the world, you know, in any manner that it can. But anyway, into our here and now, and then I'll get it over to Reva. where we are now, we've got a massive popular uprising around the world that is basically imperiling the game plan of these monsters, which was set in forth by one of the hugest crimes against humanity ever, the crimes of 9/11. And it's a big play. They can't really back off this play, especially if we continue to expose it. So they basically have to go forward. And I think that if they do execute the kind of bombardment that they have said they would in Iraq, that shock and awe bombardment of 800 cruise missiles in 48 hours, one cruise missile every 4 minutes, they're going to have to distract us and the rest of the world from that atrocity somehow, and also try to, as Barry said, stampede public opinion. So I think they are very likely to loose biological warfare or a dirty nuclear bomb or anything nuclear in a major U.S. city, and they'll probably put it right here in San Francisco Bay because, as George W. Bush said, those Northern California protesters, you know. So I think we have to be ready to call that out and actually call it out beforehand as loudly as we can to try to prevent it and respond to it when it does happen. While we still have our freedom, I think we need to engage in just the kind of actions that were done today, the massive popular peaceful gatherings that are so anti-war and pro-life are just really good in themselves, and the kind of actions that took place Friday morning in San Francisco where 200 people basically shut down the financial district for 3 hours by occupying key intersections. And that was a very happy, joyous protest too. But that's all I have to say until we can get into interaction.
I'd like to end my talk with what Don Paul started talking about, which is forms of resistance and how we can go about it. But I'm sort of thinking of what the common denominator, a common denominator of tonight is. And there's this big lie. Like, I don't think I've sat through an evening of so many lies, you know? And let's talk about the film, you know, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. They knew that was a lie. That's what got us into Vietnam. It was a pretext. They create pretexts. But then I'm thinking, with Iraq, they're not even looking for a pretext anymore. They're not looking for the smoking gun. They're not even saying it's connected to Osama. They're not even saying it's disarmament. It's really just about regime change. They're even losing the excuse for pretext. But I think one thing that we've learned tonight is, which we knew already, but the depth of the lies, the breadth of the lies, is something that we need to expose. However, on the other side, I think it's more clear to more people how many lies there are. And so many people are now saying the emperor has no clothes. It's really, really clear. And that's the positive, because it's just transparent how much they lie. So I guess one of the lies I want to talk about, so September 11th happened, and I can't even add to what the film says. You know, maybe someday history will reveal itself to us. But the response to 9/11, they say, is to make us safer. That's a lie, right? The Patriot Act does not make us safer. What I like to say about what makes us safer is to look at U.S. foreign policy and disparity of wealth. I'll bring up the National Lawyers Guild Constitution, 1937, to the ends that human rights shall be regarded as more sacred than property interests. If we started to really embrace that concept, the world would be safer. And the one thing that everybody around the world believes in and yearns for is safety in their family, in their community, among their loved ones. And it's a lie that this government is giving us that they are trying to make us safer. The truth is, greed is the prevailing impetus to what this country is trying to do. Okay, lie. I mean, I've never done this theme of lies before, but let's just see how many things fit into lies here. Guess what? The Patriot Act was not written after 9/11. Nobody believes it was. Hundreds of pages. It was passed 6 weeks after 9/11. And a little piece of Civics 101 that I like to talk about. I heard that it wasn't printed. So I did a bit of research, and it took me a bunch of calls, and it turns out, you know, because I asked the question, well, is there a law that requires that they print to make available for reading, not that all of these Congress people will actually read it, but make it available for their reading. And yes, there is such a law that requires that bills be printed and available for reading before being voted on. But that rule can be waived, and the Rules Committee recommended that that requirement be waived, and that went to the House. And the House was really closely split, 8 apart. So almost half the House said, excuse me, can we wait a minute? Can we look, have a chance to look at it before we tear up our 200-plus-year Constitution? We lost that by 8 votes, and then on the up-and-down vote, they voted it landslide. Again, that, on some level, there's a lie. Was it a landslide vote? You know, again, we lost that procedural issue. You know, talk to the children. The children really get it. What a farce of democracy that they passed this law that tears up the Constitution without having the opportunity to read it. Okay? That's what a lie that we live in a democracy. Lie that this president was elected. Lies. It's a really interesting theme tonight. Okay. It's more than the Patriot Act, of course. There's all these executive orders. And in this year and a half, nobody could have foreseen what we would have lost in this year and a half. So let's go into what some of these executive orders are that added to the Patriot Act. And if we get to the video in which I talk about the Patriot Act, I don't want to repeat some of it. We'll see how this all works. But the executive orders are what set up the military tribunals, indefinite detentions, enemy combatants I like to highlight in that it's the greatest extreme, I think, one of them. I'm going to get to worse yet. Each month there's something worse yet. But one of the executive orders was this enemy combatant category, which are citizens who can be held indefinitely, no charges, no right to see an attorney, no right to see a judge, indefinite, unprecedented. That's an executive order. So again, when we talk about, it's not just the Patriot Act, what I talk about is post 9/11 repressive legislation. And then there's Homeland Security, which came later. And again, these executive orders keep happening. Homeland Security is another piece of legislation, $200 million Pentagon effort. Poindexter heads it, for those who don't remember, he was convicted of 5 criminal counts in the Iran-Contra affair, including lying to Congress, so he's going to be, you know, in charge of surveillance. So it's a mockery of a legislative procedure, most extensive reorganization of the federal government in 50 years, rammed through Congress, 484 pages, bigger than the Patriot Act. Most in Congress hadn't read it, and many provisions, no hearings, no public discussion. In fact, one thing that I like to say is, remember when we had 3 branches of government? Everybody knows what I mean, right? There is one out-of-control, unelected executive branch, and Congress, I believe at this point, I hope they come to their senses, but they've abdicated their responsibility. There's no checks and balances. Yeah, I mean, there's no two-party system, you know. Every so often there'll be a Barbara Lee, but, you know, they're all pretty much going along because they're buying the lie that, fear is another part of the lie also. They build in the fear. In fact, okay, here's another thing. Terror alerts manufactured, like all of these codes and everything. Okay, there's this Capitol Hill Blue Report, which I never heard of, but it's probably worth looking into. And I think it's like, you know, cops in the Capitol who make some of these things public. So let's talk about the lies of how they feed in fear as a way to legitimize their agenda. Okay, sources within the FBI and the CIA. The administration is pressuring intelligence agencies to develop, quote, something, anything, to support terrorism alerts issued by the White House and the Department of Homeland Security. The FBI says most alerts are issued without any concrete data, and this is an FBI agent saying this, right? Most alerts are issued without any concrete data to back up the assumptions. The current warning level of yellow or elevated, in place since late September. The FBI never meant for all of its warnings to be made public. The FBI and CIA sources said in a recent White House memo listing the war on terrorism as a definitive advantage and fundraising tool. You know, the lies, they are telling us that what they're doing is making us safer. And every day, frankly, I feel less secure because there's more reasons for more people in the world to hate us. Every day we threaten to bomb Iraq. there's more reasons for more people in this world to hate us, and there's more reasons for us to feel at risk. Lies. All right, where do I want to go from here? I just want to say a little bit about the Patriot Act, depending on how we get to the video. But do people remember the brilliant acronym that USA Patriot Act stands for? Okay, it's Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001. Lie. It's not uniting and strengthening us. Okay. And the part that I think is the most scary in the Patriot Act is this domestic terrorism term. So it's to include activities, quote, I'm going to read it slowly because it's really, the words are really important. Activities, quote, dangerous to human life. And dangerous doesn't mean life-threatening, right? Dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or any state, that's civil disobedience, and appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce the policy of a government. And frankly, that's the democratic process, is to influence the policy of a government, you know? Are strikes intimidation or coercion? You know, I talk about how Martin Luther King would have been a domestic terrorist. Rosa Parks would have been a domestic terrorist. What they did could have resulted in a riot. And what they did was to coerce, intimidate, influence the policy of the government. Domestic terrorists, all of them. And then also, it also made a specific new crime to harbor or conceal terrorists who have or are about to commit a variety of terrorist offenses. So basically, if you house a friend who's on their way to Seattle for the WTO, you know, of course, that predated. In fact, I even like to bring up Seattle. I was at Seattle. I knew it was going to be a great thing. It was a really great thing. And we shut it down. We interfered with their ability to do business. I think that was a high point of our resistance. I mean, I'd really like to engage in conversation at the end of this about how we continue to build resistance in the context of fascism, because I think there's a give and take. The greater our resistance, the more fascism comes up. And then what shape does the resistance take? I think that's a really interesting discussion. But Seattle was a high point of our resistance, and I think their agenda has been building and building. Nobody knows when they started writing the Patriot Act, for example. But I think we need to look at that give and take and how their increased repression / fascism, neo-fascism, will impact on what form our resistance takes. I would really like to engage in that discussion here tonight. So I'm not going to say much about the Patriot Act because it's certainly not old hat. But I want to talk about this new Patriot Act because the one that's already law, which we should shame Congress for voting without having read it, and I think we're up to possibly 60 municipalities. Union City was the last one. I think we're 63. I'm not great with numbers. But we're really up there in terms of municipalities demanding repeal of the Patriot Act. And for those who live in places that it hasn't happened yet, there's sort of been an interesting evolution with that, where it started out groups saying, well, let's just demand repeal of the parts of the Patriot Act that infringe upon civil liberties. And as we learn more about it and get more assertive, it's like, let's repeal the whole goddamn thing. And more of them are saying, let's repeal the whole goddamn thing. And that's something to keep doing. In fact, the National Lawyers Guild at its convention in October passed a resolution saying that the Patriot Act and the accompanying executive orders are so unconstitutional that it raises to the level of impeachable offenses. Yeah. All right, so we have to keep working to repeal, which frankly is a political platform. You know, we'll see whether Congress ever has the guts. But Patriot Act 2 hasn't passed yet. So let's start working on it. And I just want to talk about some parts of it that are horrendous. Let me see. Well, they're calling it the Domestic Security Enhancement Act. It was leaked. Congress hasn't even seen it yet. And so Like, for example, remember when there was that TIPS program where they were going to enlist all of those citizens to spy, and people got kind of upset, you know, citizens to spy on your neighbors, you know, what is your next-door neighbor doing, and people got kind of upset, so they took it away? Well, they put it back in through this thing. This is what they do. Lies, lies, lies. They take it away, they put it in through a back door. They're going to connect, they're going to collect genetic, if it passes, they would connect genetic information. DNA would be put into a terrorist identification database, increasing surveillance powers even more so, easier for law enforcement to use the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which issues warrants way more easily, collapses distinction between domestic and international terrorism, and this repeats how the domestic terrorism term is so broadly defined anyway. Let's see, I'm sort of saving the worst one for the end here. Patriot 2 would provide immunity from liability to law enforcement engaging in spying operations. So, you know, blank check to spy. Bringing back tips. And they're also talking about... And I don't really understand how they can do this, but taking away citizenship of people who were born here.
So they can be enemy combatants.
And then are they going to end up in Guantanamo? So let's talk about Guantanamo. Did people hear the ruling of this week?
No.
that there is now this black hole. There's this place that exists on Cuba, which I love dearly, that the U.S. has no right to be on the island of Cuba anyway, and frankly, Guantanamo, we lost the lease I don't know how many decades ago, but there is this black hole there that no constitution, no international law, no domestic law, no rights apply at all, indefinitely. Indefinitely. I mean, there's just no words to describe it. Yeah, I mean... The outrage level, we have to increase the outrage level, and I want to try to swing this around because I'm actually feeling kind of positive these days. We're not in Iraq yet. We're still out there dissenting, even though they're spying on us. You know, I'm trying to switch this around. But I guess I'll end with as bad as it can be in terms of this Patriot Act, too. Okay. Proposed. If an anti-war demonstrator breaks a law during a demonstration and someone dies as a result... The protester could be subject to the death penalty. Yeah, that's really real. It's like, you know, remember Kent State, right? They were protesting and those four students were killed. Well, could all of them have gotten the death penalty? It's really, it's beyond, I mean, we're losing words to describe the concept, except that I think, you know, to be mild, we're looking at neo-fascism. I think it's just a question of degree at this point. I really do. All right, let me see what else I wanted to go into here, because I really would actually like to get into more of a discussion. I guess I want to talk a little bit. All right. For those of you who didn't hear me today, I mentioned a little story that happened to me recently, which is that I got my first FBI call a few weeks ago. Somebody left a message on the National Lawyers Guild phone. We run a hotline. And it was this really friendly voice. Hi, Reva. This is Tom Shields, FBI agent in L.A. Can you give me a call? And he was so disarmingly friendly. And, of course, I have nothing to hide.
He didn't say he was in your kitchen.
He didn't. So I almost picked up the phone. And for those of you who know me, I've said to thousands and thousands of people now, don't talk to the FBI. Call a lawyer first. So it's a lesson to all of you that you call a lawyer, and the Guild provides free lawyers for that purpose. And I want to tie that into surveillance, right? Well, first of all, I haven't said my overall theme, which I guess Sue mentioned, which is I talk about the domestic war on dissent. I don't believe this is a war on terrorism. This is a war on dissent. And the reason there's a war on dissent is because our dissent is becoming more effective. And again, we can have that discussion about where Seattle fits in this whole continuum of dissent. But I believe that's what it's about. Spying, okay? People remember the San Francisco Police Department spy scandal in 92 where the Tom Girard, the San Francisco cop, ex-CIA agent, gave... information to Anti-Defamation League guy who's Bullock, right? Roy Bullock. What did I say? It was 7,000 individuals, 200 groups were spied on, all of whom engage in constitutionally protected activity, right? And it was an embarrassment. The city got sued, and they decided they needed to clean up their act and create these surveillance guidelines. And the reason they knew they had to create surveillance guidelines is because that's an acknowledgement that excessive surveillance chills the First Amendment right to speak, to associate, right? So they created these guidelines. Well, guess what? They're not following them, right? So the Bay Guardian, thanks to the Bay Guardian, pick it up, it's this week, found out that they, in fact, have been violating the guidelines by not getting written permission to spy on us in every demonstration since the October 26th demonstration of just this past fall. And they've identified black bloc people, and it's happening. And the reason the spying is increasing, I believe, is because we're getting more effective. So let me now switch to the positive, which is really hard to find these days, frankly. But we're not in Iraq yet. Yesterday was a really awesome day in terms of shutting down downtown, and the Pacific Stock Exchange was shut down for hours. And one thing that we have to keep in mind, and I would really love to have a dialogue here, that we underestimate how much constructive damage not that many people can do, right? Really, a couple hundred people really screwed up downtown yesterday. It wasn't that many people that stood in the middle of Market Street. The buses couldn't move. I hear people got off the buses, couldn't get to work. They came out of the buses and cheered on the demonstrators. This is not a popular war.
The bus drivers cheered.
Yeah. This, you know, it's so unusual for those of us who've grown up being a minority. You know, I'm just not so sure we're such a minority anymore in terms of our politics. This is really an unpopular war. Went to the Pacific Stock Exchange. All three entrances were locked until close to noon, I think. Don't underestimate what X number of people can do. The fact that we've had many, many, many people come out month after month after month for these massive demonstrations is a victory. And again, all of this in spite of the fact that immigrants from certain countries should have real reason to be afraid to come out. In fact, I talk about three categories of people who've been calling the Guild hotline. The main vulnerable population are immigrants from certain countries. The next vulnerable population are naturalized citizens, but it's the country of origin that makes them suspect. And then the third category are American-born citizens, and it's freedom of association and political belief makes us targets. All of the above. But we're still out there, and we're still saying no to this illegitimate government. Let me see, find some other positive stuff. I'm just going to give other examples of successful forms of resistance, little pockets of it, okay? The military, City College in San Francisco, the students gave such a hard time to the Army recruiting people, they got kicked out. They're not on campus anymore. They're not going to the campus, the Ocean Street campus. You know, the students around the country are outraged. I mean, the student movement clearly is not dead. Clearly is not dead. It's strong, and better. We need to start talking about bringing draft counseling into the schools. If they're going to have ROTC in the schools, they have to have draft counseling in the schools. If they're going to teach war, they have to teach peace. We have to get our children. I have a 16-year-old son. We have to prepare them for conscientious objector status if it comes to that. There was the student walkouts, of course. I mean,
Resistance to the vaccinations, that's important.
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, another one of my favorites, librarians. Look at these different places of resistance. I talk about libraries or American as apple pie, but it's privacy because, frankly, privacy is a big part of the American persona. It's what, you know, the lie is we're the free country and we're going to save all these other countries from their repressive regimes, right? But the reality of what's going on is everything about us is supposed to be transparent. And everything about them is behind this veil of secrecy. You know, we have no more Freedom of Information Act access. You know, so much of what they do, we have no access to at all. And it's protecting industry, it's protecting government, it's protecting all that. But everything about us is open to their eyes. So a lie is that we're a free country with privacy and we're a democracy and we're good. So let me see how to end this. I think I would really like to open it up for discussion, which I think probably means we need some lights going on. But It's great that you're here, and I particularly am looking forward to a conversation because I have the feeling you're a pretty sophisticated audience. Yeah. And I think we can learn from each other. And I think, well, one thing in terms of, again, the theme of fascism and resistance. I heard Morton Sobel, who was the Ethel and Julius Rosenberg co-defendant a number of months ago. He was speaking at a Mumia convention, and he spent 18 years in prison. And he said that he thinks this period is way worse than McCarthy. And I've heard that from other people, but never anybody who served 18 years in prison. Mm-hmm. So I actually got his number, and I called him up, and I said, you know, I've repeated that several times. Can we talk? And we actually did somewhat of a presentation together. And he also talked about the interplay between resistance and fascism and how that shapes resistance. So I think I'd like to put that out there again and see what we can figure out, how we can beat this thing. And it's the only way that we're going to get peace on Earth, which is what we all want. Thank you.
We should pass a mic. Can we pass a mic down?
Is this, could this one be turned on?
Yes, it's turned on. Yes, this is a question for Reva. And I learned in high school civics that we have a rule of law in this country and that our laws are made by the legislative bodies. And what I would like to ask you is, I've been wondering for a long time now, what are these executive orders? They seem to be royal decrees. Do they trump the laws made by Congress? Is it a separate shadow government? Could you just give us a little oversight that would put this into perspective for us, please?
I don't think I'll be able to give you as good an answer as you deserve unless somebody else wants to add in. There have to be jurisdictional distinctions, but I can't really tell you what would have to go through Congress and what doesn't. And, you know, of course, executive orders can be challenged by the courts as well. There's the three branches, theoretically, right? But I should know better. And Hadley, you around? Do you remember what, you know, where the executive branch has power that it doesn't have to go to Congress? I mean, even things like the War Powers Act are playing around with when the president can do it and when Congress gets a say. And frankly, all of those things should be weighed carefully by the courts, but the courts are abdicating. But I can't actually tell you clearly where it breaks down, and I should, so maybe next time I talk I'll know the answer. Sorry about that.
Can somebody come the back? How about the person in the red shirt?
Or you could stand if you cared to.
Oh, I don't need a microphone.
Yeah,
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I have red shirts. I don't need a microphone. I got a loud voice.
Yeah.
My name is Frank Runninghorse. I'm from Concord. With my personal background, I was an organizer for Teamsters for Democratic Union. I was elected student body president at Apple Valley College, and I was the North State Chair of the Student Party various times in my life. So I've had some experience in organizing. What I think we need to talk about, I agree with the panelists that we have a lot of volumes of questions. We have a clear conspiracy
else. No, we absolutely do not. They are hiders of the lie. Well, we'll get into that.
People that we trust, not just government monkeys, to be honest,
Sue, talk about the sign up now. Make sure that your idea of getting a group together from here, you know.
Yeah, well, that is, I think that we need to get a group, that we need to make this a movement and need to start getting groups. We've had, you know, there's independent researchers and people in touch with each other, and that's why we have a sign up sheet out there, and I would like some help to organizing a meeting and a next step here, because I'm definitely willing to take some responsibility for it. So there's some pieces of paper out there with my phone number on them. And,
Sue?
Yeah.
Sue? I just wanted to say something as far as the commission. Henry Kissinger may be out, but the new chairman, Thomas Keene, actually has oil interests, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, if you look at the who's who on the 9/11 commission, five Democrats, five Republicans, the one common theme running amongst them is Council on Foreign Relations. That elite body that may very well be the real government of this country.
And Lee Hamilton.
Lee Hamilton is the ranking Democrat.
Thank you.
Right.
You know, things like the height of hypocrisy when you spent all the time we did a few years ago on O.J. Simpson almost a year, and then millions and millions go out to try and impeach Clinton, and then like Pete said back there, no pipsqueak about 9/11, which is a hell of a lot bigger than those two put together. I was wondering, Reba, that you're a constitutional attorney, right?
Well, not really, but I'm learning about the Constitution as they're taking it away. What's your question?
Write that down.
Yeah.
A couple of things I've heard that most of the executive orders, not all of them, were actually unconstitutional. I heard that, and also the fact that the National Lawyers Guild is very much involved. But I know there's also a million lawyers in the country. And I'm wondering what the other lawyers are doing. I know a lot of them are conservative, but you know, if we had most of the lawyers on the bandwagon, I think since they run the legal system.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, ultimately, at some point, some of the executive orders and possibly the whole Patriot Act will be looked at as unconstitutional. But in terms of attorneys challenging it, for example, this was actually one of the Guild's greatest accomplishments of late, is right before our convention last October, there was the California State Bar Council of Delegates. It was the California State Bar Conference. And we introduced our resolution calling for an investigation into the Patriot Act as being so unconstitutional as to render those who promoted it impeachable. And it passed overwhelmingly in the California State Bar. That's remarkable. There's other parts of things that, like the American Bar Association, I think was challenging for a while, the concept of enemy combatant and being held indefinitely. Nothing went on with that. At a certain point, different courts were saying, you know, with the Hamdi ruling, the first one was like, no, he should be able to, you know, get an attorney and have the normal due process in a criminal court of law. We lost it. So the courts are not a real friendly avenue right now. But what I'm saying is that you're right that lawyers who get the basic concept of due process, which is fairness, are challenging different pieces of it. In fact, it reminds me of another thing that I like to mention, the Lynn Stewart case. I have Know Your Rights and this Lynn Stewart information that will be outside. Everybody should have a Know Your Rights with a phone number. But the Lynn Stewart case, for those who don't know, she's a New York civil rights attorney who is facing 40 years in prison because the government listened in on her private conversations with her client, who's the blind Sikh who's serving time for being a convicted terrorist. And basically, she's facing 40 years because she's representing a client the government doesn't like. And it cuts to the center of, again, fairness. Lie is that we have a fair criminal justice system. There's no fairness to a criminal justice system if the government can listen in on attorney-client conversations. What Lynn Stewart says is the attorney-client privilege isn't about the attorney, it's about the client, and the client is the people. It's the people. It affects everybody. You know, that should be declared unconstitutional, that they could, but, you know, it's going to be a long haul, a really long haul, and all we have to do, all we can do is keep raising it. The emperor has no clothes. Lie. Things are not fair. Things are not constitutional. Things are not legal, and we have to stop it.
Okay, Don Paul had a good idea, and that is for people to make a line by this mic. I want to call on, yeah, this person over here. You could come first because you've had your hand up a long time, and I know it's not a contest about. So, okay, great.
In the last Guns and Butter, I just learned about the Northern Command, which is a posse comitatus violation. Has everybody heard of this? Okay, so, Reeve, I filled you in on my Hiroshima Day arrest. The Northern Command is like the U.S. version of the Southern Command, right? It's Chad Watson, the MP that had me arrested, is a MP at the weapons station, and he's a Concord Reserve officer. So I peaceably assemble on Hiroshima Day where the nukes came from. MP says, you can't take any pictures. Concord shows up, drags me off to jail. So they fabricate the transcript, as I described to you. But could you just comment on the unconstitutionality of this force amplification where if the local police can't get the local protesters, then they have these, you know, these high, I mean, the transcript from the November 13th trial that I had says that I was sitting 25 foot from the roadway, but the cop and I at the trial agreed I was 25 foot from the center of the Port Chicago Highway, and I was sitting on the tracks that run between the highway and the frontage road where there's obviously no 25 foot. They took out the word center from the transcript, so you have an obvious criminal felony fabrication of evidence here going on under the nose of George Miller, who's not going to do anything because he never returns any of our calls about this kind of thing. And you can't really criticize a good guy because they want to get rid of him too. Okay. But I'll just speak to that, anybody that can.
Well, then not.
I can't respond to it except that police break rules and laws all the time. In fact, one example today is the police told us a week ago that legal observers so identified would be recognized as neutral and not be arrested. Well, five of them got arrested today. You know, we could go on and on about that they don't want us to exercise our rights, and the police have a free rein to lie, and they do it all the time.
But my arrest shows martial law has been declared, so if I have a right to know the law, but my congressman has a duty to know the law, and the judge has a duty, the court has a duty to declare the law, but I'll get arrested if I return to North Congress.
Well, and also, posse comitatus basically has been in the garbage can since the beginning of the so-called war on drugs. The U.S. military has been very much involved in supposed domestic policing.
I'd like to say two things. One, Ralph Eberhard is the head of Northern Command. He was head of NORAD September 11th, 2001, so he got his reward. The other thing is, I think we can little depend on any kind of governmental means to affect our fate. You know, I work with a group in Hunter's Point we've called From the Ground Up, and I think that's what we need to do to reach out and make sure that the next time we do a demonstration downtown that impacts the financial district or whatever, that it is much larger and involves more, even more of the middle class than the last one did, because we really have to save ourselves and devise new means of kind of self-government such as have originated in Argentina over the last year or so.
In order to deal with this thing, we need to have the truth. And tonight I had experience of somebody handing me a leaflet saying that Ramsey Clark was a bad guy. And now you, Paul, say that Zinn and all the, and Chomsky are bad guys. And I don't know. I think there's the liars get into organizations like this to spread lies, to disrupt us. And I'd like a little clarity on that.
Sure. I meant to say that only Chomsky, and I don't know enough about Howard Zinn. I do know enough about Noam Chomsky's response to 9/11 to know that he should not be on an investigating committee. Michelle Chosudovsky has done very good work, so I would not include him among that, but definitely I think Chomsky has failed his responsibility as an icon and a conscience to us. I don't know enough. Go ahead, it's interchanged. Yeah.
In his book, The People's History of the United States, he does not deal with the Federal Reserve Bank. And I'm still wondering what's going on, is that a right-wing conspiracy? Anyway, he does not deal with the Federal Reserve Bank, doesn't deal with JFK assassination, and he does not deal with Israel and the Soviet and American complicity.
The People's
and
History of the United States.
The people, yes, I'm saying, but he
doesn't read this, but don't, if you read the book, you understand.
But he takes two very controversial points and clearly omits to deal with them.
We're talking about Chomsky.
Zinn, People's History of the United States. Thank you.
So does that mean we get the guillotine?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Come on, let's. Why don't we proceed?
Next question.
Okay. My question is a general one to the panel, but also to the people in the room, and it's a statement that precedes the question. For many, many years as an African American in this country, we have talked about, you know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and we talked about consistently the practices of the police departments. These practices are historically documented, they're known. People didn't believe it until there was a videotape that depicted Rodney King. Then another event happened with Donovan Jackson down in L.A. So my question is, why do we have to keep covering the same ground with regard to law enforcement? Once you learn certain lessons, then you go forward and build on those lessons, and they enable you to sort out the world. Now, I'm going to, if a child is born, a child has a birthmark, they don't lose that birthmark. If this country was born on the enslavement of Africans, on the genocide against the native people, likewise against Chinese and so forth, internment during the Second World War, it's not going to lose those stripes, that birthmark, all of a sudden. The FBI, COINTELPRO, it didn't go anywhere. I mean, what makes people think it went anywhere? You know, I mean, they back off of things as long as there's a movement, as long as there's struggle. But when that ceases, they move forward again. And so what does it take for people to believe us when we tell them consistently that the police are not your friends, that they are the enemy, that the state is a repressive apparatus? You know, what does it take for people to believe that?
Yeah, if I can speak in response to that, I think that's a really important perspective, because there is an extent to which the reaction to which the implementation of the Patriot Act and so forth is a codification of these sorts of excesses that you're referring to. And there is, again, there's this sort of paradox where the United States, founded as it was on the enslavement of African people and the genocide of the native people, then posits itself as a civilized nation under the rule of law. This What we're seeing is actually the internal logic of what this country is about. It's what the Bush administration represents is not an anomaly. It's not something that can be corrected because it springs forth from what the United States has always been. And it really would necessitate a fundamental revisioning of what the nature of the United States is all about, because one of the major problems with the reaction to the Bush administration and what they are doing is that it comes from people who failed to recognize the movement towards this trend under the preceding administrations. I mean, Reva talked about how the Patriot Act was clearly written before 9/11. A single event before 9/11 was the Oklahoma City bombing, which was exactly the same type of operation. The myth around Oklahoma bombing, Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building. Again, nothing, that is another big lie. But the Oklahoma bombing was coordinated by U.S. intelligence and the FBI and the ATF in order for Clinton to pass the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And people people were manipulated through that. A lot of liberals supported the Domestic Anti-Terrorism Act because this was the way to get those racists in Idaho. And so the government has been running rings around us for a long time, and I think in a lot of ways with the Bush administration, we're waking up way too late. The fix is in. There's no way that through impeachment or any of these other mechanisms it can be corrected. I think what people in Argentina, Colombia, in the rest of the especially in the third world, where people are not conditioned and ensnared within the superstructure, where you have to pay taxes and have a bank account and all those things. I think the only real way it cannot be reformed. We don't want to return. What do we want to return back to? How can this be reformed to be made better within the current superstructure? It's impossible.
Also, thank you. Also, people, it's commonly recognized that African Americans and the indigenous inhabitants of this country are repressed. But the reality is the vast majority of people of European ancestry have been repressed in this country as well. A lot to do with class. For example, way back in 1877, the U.S. Army was used to break the National General Strike, something that's not very well known, in 1877, July of 1877. Or throughout the late 19th and 20th century, about how the police was used against the working class trying to self-organize. I grew up in the 60s, and we did find out a lot about what the police was doing back then, specifically, once again, in South Central or in New York City, where I grew up. The last 30 years, though, has been a campaign of what I would call a counter-revolution on the cultural front, basically to roll back everything that people learned and gained during the 60s. And part of that was much more centralized control of the media and a selling of culture of depoliticization and self-absorption. And that's, I think, why we're back at square one.
Yeah, I had two questions. The first one is this. Do you believe that the separation of powers is a democratic institution? Because Montesquieu and Laws says that the purpose of the separation of powers is to ensure that the minority could control the majority. So I think that's a myth that we learn in civics class, that the separation of powers is democratic. It's not. It's anti-democratic. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And the second is, in Europe, they've already gone in direct action against the U.S. military. They're stopping trains. They're carrying goods in Italy. They're stopping weapons in Turkey from being unloaded. They're stopping weapons in Greece. During the Battle of Minsk, in June of 1944, the biggest battle of the Second World War, the partisans in the Belarus, not one troop train got through from Nazi Germany to help the Nazi forces there. So this is the question. Do you think that the American movement is too passive on their resistance to this war, and we should be taking more direct action against the state apparatus, the army and the Navy and the other institutions that are engaged in destroying these third world countries.
If I could take a shot at the second question first, I think what we need to do is to appeal to the military forces of the United States to act against treason. I think that should be the first step, to encourage a counter coup, so to speak. We won't have class structure changed by that, but we will at least gain some breathing room. I think we should make that honest appeal to them, present the case of the crime to our military personnel. And I've talked with quite a few. I make a point of talking with police and firemen and whoever, and they're a lot more sympathetic often than people in the doctrinaire left. So that would be my first thing. But in terms of being more vigorous, in terms of protest and stoppage, absolutely.
I would add also, you know, when I encourage people to let's block Market Street, that's what, I agree that we need to do more vigorous and consistent demonstrations and learn from Europe, which has always turned out more numbers. In terms of the balance of power, I need to think about that. But one of the things that I like to talk about is our founding fathers were not radicals, right? And they were all fathers. There were no women because women couldn't vote. Blacks couldn't vote. If you didn't own property, you couldn't vote. So clearly the system was flawed from the beginning, right? But I do believe that the three branches of government were put in there to address abuse of power because that's what the colonialists had experienced from Britain, right? And this country was born of dissent, and the dissent was abuse of power. But I would agree that this system was set up for wealthy white men. And until we change some basic premise of this system and this country, I agree that they're trying to keep the masses down, but our job is to make it so that we prevail.
Yeah. Okay. I just had one quick comment before I just make the little thing I wanted to address. On the thing of Oklahoma City, a lot of people don't realize that John Doe number 2 has been identified since right after that incident occurred. An FBI agent, at least one FBI agent, lost his job for identifying him. And it appears that the man was on scene, as well as other defectors from Iraq were on scene, not defectors because they were actually brought here when Saddam Hussein was still our ally, and trained by U.S. military, brought into civilian life, trained by military and not used for military purposes, were on scene there to later be able to blame that on Iraq. And it does look like they were about to do that and pulled back on it thanks to the activism of people around the world, because this all was coming out. It was only coming out in little bits, underground press, ever since 1995. But last year, it's all over the mainstream British press that this guy, Hashim Hussein al-Husseini, was John Doe number 2. No doubt about it. FBI agents who tried to arrest him had it blocked from higher ups. So, you know, you see how far in advance all this was planned. This was not just planned a couple years before 9/11. This is decades-long planning. Mm-hmm. And one thing, just my main point, which I'll make quicker than that point, was that I think in the long-term scope of things, of how we go about completely changing the system so that there is equality and so that we have real democracy, which has never existed in maybe in a couple of places in the world for very, very short periods of time, but where everyone has equal power. That's no elites, period, okay? That's what we have to ensure. So we have to watch out for the Hegelian dialectic of left-right, because what happens is that, you know, I'm going to say something that may be very unpopular with some people. It's been unpopular with a lot of people I greatly admire, good friends of mine, but communism is no solution to capitalism. And I'll make a point. Ingalls exploited child labor, okay? Communist China, which you can make the argument it's not communist China anymore, whatever, it still is. Communist China is partnered with capitalist America. There are over 600 documented slave labor camps in China that are making goods that Americans are buying at Walmart. And that's just Walmart. And that is that is slave labor. These are not just like, you can't even get away with calling it a sweatshop. It's worse than that.
I'd like to address that. I think the one thing you said you're right is contesting the use of the term communist, because I believe basically the last time communists had any influence in so-called communist Russia was about two or three days after the Bolsheviks took over, where I think that basically the real communists got put in jail. And I don't think there was ever any communism in communist China. But that aside, how do we get from here to there? And I do think I'd like to reiterate what Don said about Argentina. I think people ought to learn about right now, because I think that's not an historic anomaly. I think people have moved in to try to create organs of direct democracy, such as mass assemblies. And this is precisely what's happening in Argentina right now. People ought to read Indie Media Argentina, as well as writings by James Petras and other writers. I think it's a very important phenomenon, and I think the progressive left media in this country has really fallen short in trying to give air to that phenomenon.
Well, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Well, we've got five people here, and I think we're going to stop it after that and see what people want to do next.
I have a couple questions and a comment, but I'll be brief. The questions, first question regards sources. I'm afraid I missed much of the gentleman, the mechanical engineer's talk, but I wondered if you had any sources that you were working from and whether you were familiar with the book Painful Questions and what you thought of that.
It's an interesting book. I think people should read it. I have certain problems with Mr. Hofschmidt's some particulars of his analysis. I do have actually several interesting articles on the web that I put together, and if people want to, I'd be happy to. I have about 10.
Could you give a website, or are you just going to give copies? Do you have the website?
I have.
What is the website?
Well, then I would have to give you article numbers.
He wants to give you specific articles.
Specific articles.
That's fine. Well, great. Yeah, if you could give me one at least. Thank you very much. And for the gentleman speaking about Africa, you mentioned two books, and I didn't catch the author of the book, Secrets of the Rwandan Genocide. What was the author's name?
Oh, his name was Charles Onana.
Could you spell that?
A-O-O-N-A-N-A.
A-O-O-N-A-N-A.
And he's based in Paris.
O-N-A-N-A.
O-A.
No, O-N-A-N-A. O-N-A-N-A.
Right. Right. And the other was Wayne Genocide. Okay. Those are the two.
Wayne Mattson.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
My comment is basically that since the import of 9/11 seems to me to be that it's an issue that, when exposed, brings to light the rottenness at the core of the entire system, and so exposing is such a crucial issue. Considering the dire straits that we're in and the concentration of power in such few hands of such fascist madmen, it seems important that the movement right now is a time to unite and not divide. I feel 9/11, bringing to light the contradictions of 9/11 and exposing the truth of it, hopefully, will be, you know, something to unite both progressive left and libertarian right. I think that's the only way, that's the only strategy that could possibly take down this system. But in order to do that, of course, we can't be dividing the left. It's you know, presents a contradiction when we start, you know, throwing stones at Noam Chomsky, at Howard Zinn, who people that most, many of us people on the left feel are not our enemies but are our friends. And it's important that we try to win them over and not, you know, not make them into enemies, not pull out the guillotine and start chopping off heads. So how can we expose the truth of 9/11 without creating, you know, these sectarian divisions like all these little socialist groups have for so many years that have kept any real progress from happening on the left, to allow them to then bring people in on the right and get some kind of unity going.
Many people have publicly tried to engage Noam Chomsky in particular in a discussion about 9/11. He refuses to engage in it. He has said in public and private letters and in lectures that he finds it to be no more than a random series of events that might have occurred any other day, and you could extrapolate those events to show a plot to blow up the White House on October 15th, 1997. And he basically takes a very condescending and dismissive attitude. He did that when Gore Vidal dared to raise the possibility that the Bush administration knew, and he was questioned about that. He's done it in a couple private letters that have come across the internet. So the effort has been made to, you know, seriously engage Noam Chomsky. I have a lot of respect for Noam Chomsky and the work he's done, but it's not happening. So we want to have the broadest public forum possible. This is one step in that direction. I know with my book, it's been kind of shunted aside or not even considered. I know with Michael Rupert on KPFA, there has been an effort by Norman Solomon and others to not have him on the air, and so on and so forth. So our deduction is that there is a certain part of the left that does not want to touch 9/11 and the crimes there. As to how to remedy that, I think gatherings like this and engagement of people like yourself, maybe calling KPFA or as a body and treating KPFA to have a 2-hour-long show, you know, from 8 to 10 on Wednesday night between certain points of view about 9/11 and what it means.
Yeah, just to add to that, hopefully without being redundant, those of us, you know, it's not, again, it's not a, that, you know, those of us doing research around 9/11 woke up on September 12th and said, you know, we have to get to the bottom of this. This is a part of a pattern that we've seen over decades. You know, within the United States, as I mentioned, your Oklahoma City bombing, the 1993 attempted bombing of the World Trade Center. The fellow, blind sheikh that, what's the name of that attorney?
Lynn Stewart.
That Lynn Stewart is representing was brought into the United States by the, he was a CIA agent, he was brought in the, see, but this sort of discourse is not, is deliberately not discussed in the progressive media. It's not that those of us engaged in this research are seeking to divide. All we're trying to do is put forward the information. But the attacks come from the David Corns and the Norman Solomons with a lot of ad hominem. And it's clear that it's not simply a matter of unity. I think that a lot of people on the left, so-called left, are really part of the superstructure in some of them in acknowledged ways, some not. One of the ways in which that mechanism works is through foundations, where a lot of the progressive nonprofits, the limits to which they can criticize the system are circumscribed, and they know instinctively those limits. I mean, they're very good at criticizing the mainstream journalists about the same exact thing that they do. The people at FAIR and those kind of outfits. There's been no discussion of the events around around 9/11. They say almost exact same things that George Bush says. George Bush made the statement about, you know, dismissing conspiracy theories around 9/11. David Corn is saying the same thing. Norman Solomon is saying the same thing. Larry Bensky on KPFA is saying the same thing. So there has, you know, you have to wonder whose interests they're representing, and I don't think I think it's a very complex issue. I think a lot of it has to do with intellectual frameworks, intellectual approaches to things. I think a lot of it has to do with territoriality, about control over information. But what the gentleman spoke about earlier with respect to the left-right dichotomy is a very important dynamic there. I think that is it's a dynamic of divide and rule. When I talked about Rwanda, Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, the president of Uganda, a lot of the actors involved in precipitating that genocide and moving into the Congo and causing the mayhem there were trained as Marxists. These were people who were trained in Cuba, North Korea, and they have now switched and become handmaidens of the capitalist agenda. So I think it's really important for people on the left to examine these notions of the left and the right, because most of the opposition we talk about how can we oppose the system. A lot of opposition to the system is there, but it's been marginalized and ridiculed. People in, you know, these militias in Montana and Idaho, you know, creating their own currencies. I mean, certainly, yeah, these people are racist and sexist and anti-Semitic and what have you, but at the end of the day, they have recognized that they didn't care when black people and Native Americans were getting killed, but when the government came for them, they certainly woke up. But should we begrudge them for that? The fact is they did wake up. I mean, when the people were killed at Waco, and you watch that video, what was it called? The Rules of Engagement. You watch the testimony in Congress, and you wonder who the Republicans are in the role of Democrats, and the Democrats in the role of Republicans. The Democrats completely defended that massacre of people in the most cold-blooded way. I mean, for Tom Lantos, wasn't a big surprise there. But Waco is something that people on the left don't care about, because that was Timothy McVeigh's concern. So these are the things that I think are really important to think about as we go forward.
I want to bring up two aspects of law, or two big laws, that I think could help us if they were out in the media and to win allies within the establishment, to win whistleblowers, etc. And I'm going to try to be as brief as I can, but I don't know if you know that there were 41 human rights lawyers and law professors that sent a demand to John Howard, the president of or the prime minister of Australia, stating that even if the United Nations gave a fig leaf of legitimacy to the Iraq war, it was still a war crime. It's still a crime against the peace as defined by the UN Charter. And so the first of these is the UN. And so everybody that participates in this could be tried on the dock. And if we can get out of this climate where we're thinking in terms of, you know, tomorrow, and these are things that apply to everybody here in our government, too. The UN Charter, and the second is the Constitution. I don't hear it said by anybody that every senator and congressperson, plus everybody else in the government, takes an oath, I promise to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And it's too heavy to say it to Nancy Pelosi that when you capitulated on this and that, that you were, you know, committing treason against the Constitution. And so to get this out there, there are a lot of very, very good people in government that I think could be our allies if they could wake up their conscience and see the big laws that really apply to all of us and them and what's important in government. So I just wanted to hear what you had to say about, you know, those things and how do we get it out in the media? I mean, I found that thing about Australia on the internet. Yeah.
I keep waiting for people of courage in Washington, and it's slow in coming. It's slow in coming, but I absolutely agree with you that, you know, another lie is they're patriotic and we're not. The slogan, Real Patriots Defend the Constitution, you know, we have to reverse it. But the more we say it as clearly as you did, maybe we'll shame some of those elected officials in Washington to stick their neck out. You know, like Wayne Morse was one of the two who voted against the Tonkin Gulf resolution. You know, we need more of those people to at least, you know, at least be registered as a dissenting voice, even if we don't ultimately prevail. And you said that really clearly, and we need to get it out there, and we need to demand the KPFA says it more. And that's all we can do.
Hi. First off, I want to thank you. I think, you know, you're doing a lot tonight to explode a lot of myths, and that's really useful, especially, Don, I think it's Don, what you're saying about fascism. I've been saying that for months, and you're the first person I've seen that's actually, like, codified it, and that's good. And, Joe, if I could get a copy of your speech, I would love to do that. But I need to challenge everybody in this room, including you all, to understand that there's a lot more mythology that needs to be exploded. Great. And, you know, frankly, if it's not 9/11 in Iraq, it's any other situation going all the way back to Helena Troy. We're not talking about 50 years of world history and politics. We're not talking about 500 years of world history and politics. We are talking about probably 12,000 years. And when you say, well, we've got to stand up and oppose something, well, that's all well and good, but you're giving the opposition all of your energy. Do you understand? It's all about they're saying, we're going to do this, and then we're saying, well, we're going to stop you. And well, meanwhile, you're not doing the things that you want to be doing. And that is the biggest way that they're winning right now. So that's the challenge for everyone here, is to, within yourselves, figure out what it is you need to be doing. And that's all about, it's all about they're saying, we're going to do this. And then we're saying, well, we're going to stop you. And well, meanwhile, you're not doing the things that you want to be doing. And that is the biggest way that they're winning right now. So that's the challenge for everyone here, is to, within yourselves, figure out what it is you need to be doing. And it's not necessarily protesting in the streets. I don't want to say anything bad about people who are protesting in the streets. I think it's important. But I think there's a lot more out there. And I think there's, you know, some places to start. There's a book by Alan Weissman called Gaviotas. There's people who, in the worst part of Colombia, in the freaking deserts of Colombia, who for 30 years have been doing the kind of things that, with millions of dollars of resources, we couldn't do in Arizona in that stupid biosphere thing. Okay, for 30 years on no money, they have reforested and re-jungleized the desert. Okay, and these are a bunch of people with, you know, no real education. You know, so if they can do it, we can do it. There's all kinds of things we could be doing right now that don't have to involve fighting and battles.
Another world is possible.
Lots of worlds are possible. Lots of civilizations are possible. Another great book, Beyond Civilization by Daniel Quinn. I highly recommend it because it's not just about our civilization defeating their civilization. There are any number of civilizations. So I've said my piece.
Just one little remark. And I think one of our greatest strengths today and yesterday was that the protests were joyous. They weren't so much about battling obvious criminals, although that, I think that really does have to be a part of it. They were about expressing who each one of us is, and they had to do with dance and music and so forth, and real alternative modes of expression. And I keep thinking of what Joseph said about the superstructure, and it's like the corporate state itself and its ordinary workings is a great crime that's covered by lies. So basically, we have to abdicate from the corporate state. That's all.
Yeah, we need to move it along here, and you spoke already. So really, nobody else after Aaron, and then I'm going to see what people want to do. And if you want to have more of discussion, we can do that, but we have other options.
Video.
Thank you for your generosity in giving me space to say something. I really want to thank you for talking about WTO and the protest in Seattle, because I do believe that is the heart of what this is about. And I'm so thankful for the brother who spoke about us learning what it is we're supposed to do and doing it, because one of the things I'm learning is that the most revolutionary act we can do is teach ourselves how to feed ourselves again and what that truly means, and that the FBI will come and get someone who's doing permaculture training on the Black Hawk Reservation and say, if you don't want trouble, don't come on this land again, because we want it. You know, and I'm thinking that as these protests are happening about the war, that the agribusiness is going on as usual, and we are daily asking, demanding countries to lift tariffs on U.S. products, demanding that countries not subsidize local agricultural production, while we are over-subsidizing our farmers, depleting our underground water sources, and really the all of it, you know, and it's just like, sometimes I feel like the attention of the movement so necessarily and understandably single-minded on stopping this war, it has in some way diverted some of our attention from the other war that's happening. And there is so much misery and true desperation that are being amplified each moment of every day by agribusiness, that it just seems to be a level of misery that will happen whether or not this war happens. So anyway, I know I'm speaking too much, and I know people want to move on, but I don't know. I just wanted to maybe engage with the ecological farming associations. You know, how do we build our movement? And maybe there are some farmers here. And lift the economic sanctions on Haiti.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to defend the left and the existence of the left against this idea that somehow the left-right dichotomy is somehow phony. The left, in principle, represents equality, or the tendency towards equality, or the right represents privilege and inequality. And we can make alliances sometimes on some issues with people who are on the right. Certainly, you know, on questions of defense of civil liberties, for example, you know, exposing certain groups of scoundrels, but let's remember that rich people have been screwing poor people long before there was a Federal Reserve, long before there were, you know, with this fascism. I'm not saying we shouldn't pay attention to these particular phenomena, but let's realize the basic issue in the world is still that some people having all the wealth and power, or most of the wealth and power, and screwing those who don't, and keeping those who don't from getting it.
Aaron, I'd like to agree with that to to a big extent. I feel like, well, the origin of the real left is the idea of seeking solutions via community, which is actually the root word of communism, basically community control, versus the right, which seeks solutions via individual channels, in other words, individual solutions. And I do agree that there is a difference with that. Be that as it may, I think that there's been a split between the real left, the one that's organized around community, and the established left, which has become just another form of hierarchical power. And in many ways, actually, just another form of capitalism. Basically, the established left is just the left wing of capital, and that has to be recognized by whatever remains of the real left. Or actually, I think a lot remains. I think it's out there. I think it needs to regain its own voice.